I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. This is the second half of our interview with Andrew Fenton, who is part of the Novel Tech Ethics Group at Dalhousie University and the author of an essay called Buddhism and Neuroethics, The Ethics of Pharmaceutical Cognitive Enhancement. You can find the first half of this interview at ieet.org. I was asking Andrew about a characteristically Buddhist approach to this question of cognitive enhancement and about how Buddhists reject the notion of authenticity. So the Buddhist approach wouldn't focus so much on whether it's authentic or not, whether you're your real you when you're on in a drug state, but it would focus more on the question of whether it's skillful or not to take drugs, whether it's going to cause you and other people suffering.
That's right. And anyone that, and we all know someone who is within, say, a spectrum of mental health where they are more or less depressive and have benefited, say, from the use of Prozac, will tell you that even though, again, Prozac can be very addictive and the brain can become and the body itself can become very dependent on what Prozac does in the body, it has helped people, even people that, you know, 30 years ago wouldn't have been diagnosed with anything like a clinically significant expression or presentation of depression, have benefited from Prozac. And there's nothing, I think, untoward about that. I think if Prozac is used in someone's life who even 30 years ago wouldn't have been presenting with clinically significant symptoms, if that person benefits from that, if it alleviates their dissatisfaction, if it helps them better engage with those in their immediate community and those in their non-immediate community, that's a good thing.
I had to laugh, and this probably makes me a bit of a Dharma nerd, but when you were talking in the essay about how Mahayana approach to achieving enlightenment, but at the same time realizing that ordinary mind is the essence of enlightenment, this non-dualist approach to ordinary mind, you make the point that if it's non-paradoxical for the Zen master to be hitting you over the head to concentrate harder on your cushion in order to achieve ordinary mind, is equally non-paradoxical for you to take Ritalin in order to help you achieve ordinary mind.
Oh, sure, sure. And there are important questions here. I mean, it's I think, again, their concern with dichotomous thinking is very important. I think we do get caught up in acts and non-acts. Famously, now that the administration is gone, you can breathe a sigh of relief about the Bush administration, and their dichotomous thinking of good versus evil, us versus them, is incredibly harmful. You can see and of course, this is nothing new. You can look through history and see the damage that kind of dichotomous thinking does. And so I think the Mahayana who have worried about this are dead right about it. It's just, as you said, you can exaggerate that. They can come at a price where you couldn't even practice Buddhism if you take that too far.
Form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Okay, so then you apply these reflections to the case of Ritalin. Tell us what your conclusions were there.
Well, my basic conclusion there is, first of all, a cautionary note, as I've been mentioning, and as well as you're sympathetic to, and that is, you know, we're in very early days with these synthetic agents. We have to watch out for the consequences. We have to watch out for their addictive quality. We have to see if they do alleviate harm versus enable or enhance harm. Now, in a context where they don't, imagine that Ritalin doesn't. Imagine that healthy people can use Ritalin wisely so that every so often it can augment their attention. It could maybe reduce their need for sleep. Imagine without a strong side effect profile. So imagine that the side effects, because everything has side effects, but imagine the side effects aren't so much worse than, say, caffeine use, which of course has a side effect profile, or alcohol use or nicotine use. Then what do we do with it? Well, it's not at all clear what the Buddha should say there, but what is relatively clear is that there's no a priori reason to say, well, they shouldn't do it. Because it's a question of does it facilitate or increase attachment? Does it facilitate or increase aversion? Does it facilitate or increase delusion? If it doesn't, and even better, if it actually becomes a means to actually increase our sense of generosity or increase our sense of loving kindness or increase our sense of the world around us so that we have a more wise approach or a more prudential approach to the world that's less harmful, that's a good thing. That means that Buddhism not only need not oppose these synthetic agents, it may actually, at least within certain traditions or within certain lineages of Buddhism, be incumbent to actually support their use to remain consistent, because otherwise they're going to trap themselves in inconsistencies, because as we've been discussing, Buddhism is about mind transformation. It uses technology. It uses technology that has the danger of being addictive. Folks that meditate, you know, you get some people that talk about horror stories from meditation, people that become dependent on meditation in ways that interfere with them going out to their workplaces, etc. And so Buddhists have to be very, very careful about their response to the use of mind transformation technology that perhaps is simply unfamiliar. We shouldn't be so scared of the unfamiliar that we make rash judgments that catch us in inconsistency. And that's basically the conclusion I caution to Buddhists who might be worried with the use of current synthetic technology to modify or modulate our psychological state.
I suspect that Ritalin, methylphenidate, and drugs like Provigil or Modafinil, which is also a drug that allows people to stay awake and concentrate, and there are other classes of drugs in this stimulant or quasi-stimulant category, although Modafinil isn't, strictly speaking, a stimulant, doesn't have stimulant effects, but keeps you awake and allows you to concentrate. These kinds of drugs are going to be easier for Buddhists to accept because they are Buddhism is basically all about mindfulness, or at least the contemplative tradition of Buddhism is about mindfulness. There are other drugs, so for instance, ecstasy, which induces feelings of loving kindness. We're also about loving kindness, and we also want to generate feelings of loving kindness, but we may have a bigger problem, or Buddhists in general may have a bigger problem with these kind of mood-altering drugs, which pose probably a greater problem from a point of view of addiction or intoxication from the Buddhist tradition.
That's right. And I think with drugs like ecstasy, the worry is that they're very short term, and so they don't. It's not at all clear what the level of transformation is that they offer. It seems that, though they can, I've known a few colleagues in my grad school life that have taken ecstasy, and you know it hasn't done them any harm, as far as I know. And you know I've seen them when they're on it, and they're certainly very cuddly and very very compassionate and very happy. Not sure about the long term transformative effects, and that's an area that is legitimately raised as a question when it comes to these techniques, because Buddhism is about a more longer term transformation as we go along the journey. And you can say this about a number of the other synthetics, that there is the question of, well, what's the longer term benefit of transformation through the use of these technologies. And I think that's a good question, along with the question of their addictive qualities. Tricycle, the magazine, had a fifth anniversary in 96, I think, on psychedelics and Buddhism. And there was this discussion of some of these drugs in that volume. Very interesting. You have people like Robert Aiken talking about it and talking about how LSD use, for instance, in the 60s was the gateway for a number of current Buddhist practitioners. And they just moved away from use of the drugs once they started using techniques and technology within the Buddhist traditions that offered a more longer-term transformation. And so it's an important conversation to have, and I think it's already there in Buddhism. I think particularly among so-called Western Buddhists, there's been this discussion of how the counterculture became a gateway for a number of Buddhists of a generation preceding us, and how some of them have moved beyond that. Some of them still use them. Ram Dass, apparently, at the time that this volume was out, was talking about how he still used psychedelics occasionally just to remind himself of certain potentials of transformation of consciousness, but by no means is dependent on them for his practice. And
There's a book out called Zigzag Zen, which is a collection of those kinds of stories. And yeah. I think one of the points that is made in that book is that in the Zen tradition, for instance, you have the distinction between Kensho and long-term personality transformation that might be the result of other kinds of experiences or practice. Kensho being a short-term insight into the altered state of consciousness, but that might not have any lasting impact except to give you a taste of what kind of changes you might be able to accomplish if you worked hard at it.
And, that's right.
And I think certain kinds of drugs might, even if their effects are just temporary, they might change our perspective in that kind of way.
Yeah, and that's right. And that's an important benefit, side effect. This is something that came out of those conversations in Tricycle, is that it's not all bad. Some of it is quite good, and it shouldn't be painted with a brushstroke of this is all bad. We have to get out of it because these are potential intoxicants, because so much are potential intoxicants. And so I think it's important to keep a perspective. You can do the same thing with mindfulness retreats, right? Folks go on 10-day retreats. They have these wonderful and profound spiritual experiences, go back to their day-to-day living and lose what they gained in that 10 days. And so what do we say there about the long-term effects of the 10-day retreat? Well, I think the 10-day retreats are still good. I think they play an important part in people's practice, but we should be very careful about what we don't exaggerate as we wrestle with the use of unfamiliar technology in, say, Buddhist practice for transformation, so we don't, to use the cliche, throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Well, Andrew, I'm really glad you wrote this essay. I think it's a great contribution. We've been talking with Andrew Fenton. He's part of the Novel Tech Ethics Group at Dalhousie University and author of the essay Buddhism and Neuroethics, The Ethics of Pharmaceutical Cognitive Enhancement. It was published in Developing World Bioethics. Thanks so much for coming on today.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
This has been part two of a two-part interview with Andrew Fenton of the Novel Tech Ethics Group at Dalhousie University and author of an essay called Buddhism and Neuroethics, The Ethics of Pharmaceutical Cognitive Enhancement. You can find the first half of this interview at ieet.org. The consciousness and neurotech-related news is just a constant stream of stuff. So I tap into it every once in a while and thought I'd share a little bit of the more recent findings and studies here. One just came out last week, February 10th, and it was published, a summary of this article was published at scientificamerican.com. The title is Brain Surgery Boosts Spirituality, Lose a Tumor and Gain Self-Transcendence. This is by Janelle Weaver. Removing part of the brain can induce inner peace, according to researchers from Italy. Their study provides the strongest evidence to date that spiritual thinking arises in or is limited by specific brain areas. To investigate the neural basis of spirituality, Cosimo Urghisi, a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of Udine, and his colleagues turned to people with brain tumors to assess the feeling before and after surgery, 3 to 7 days after the removal of tumors from the posterior part of the brain in the parietal cortex, patients reported feeling a greater sense of self-transcendence. This was not the case for patients with tumors removed from the frontal regions of the brain. Self-transcendence, this is a quote from Salvatore Agliati, self-transcendence used to be considered just by philosophers and crank New Age people. This is the first real close-up study of spirituality. That's not entirely true. We're dealing with complex phenomenon that's close to the essence of being human. Of course, there have been many studies of meditators and prayer and other kinds of phenomena in fMRIs and with other kinds of investigatory techniques. But at any rate, these guys are doing it with surgery. The authors pinpointed two parts of the brain that, when damaged, led to increases in spirituality, the left inferior parietal lobe and the right angular gyrus. These areas at the back of the brain are involved in how we perceive our bodies in spatial relation to the external world. The authors of the study in the journal Neuron say that their findings support the connection between mystic experiences and feeling detached from the body. Now, that's one specific definition of a spiritual feeling. The most surprising part was the rapidity of the change, says Ergisi. This discovery shows that some complex personality traits are more malleable than previously thought. The researchers interviewed 88 people with brain tumors of various severities. 20 of these people had benign tumors, and although they underwent surgery, no tissue was removed. All 88 people participated in interviews about their religious habits and beliefs before surgery and afterwards, and answered a series of true-false questions that assessed spirituality. The questionnaire tapped the three main components of self-transcendence: losing yourself in the moment, feeling connected to other people and to nature, and believing in a higher power. Examples of the items of the questionnaire include, I often become so fascinated with what I'm doing that I get lost in the moment, like I'm detached from time and place. Or, I sometimes feel so connected to nature that everything seems to be a part of one living organism. The researchers then mapped the precise areas of the patient's brains where they had lesions as a result of surgery. Previous studies had shown that a broad network of frontal and parietal brain regions underlie religious beliefs. But spirituality does not seem to involve exactly the same regions of the brain as religion, which is kind of confirming of the way many people parse the two. In the past, neurologists have observed spiritual changes in patients with brain damage, but it is not something that they systematically evaluate. We usually stay away from it, not because it's not an important topic, but because it's very private and personal, says Rick Vandenberg, a neurologist at the University Hospital in Leuven, Belgium. This paper is very interesting, but like many pioneering studies, it leaves open many questions, of course. Probably the most worrisome aspect of the study is the way that the authors measured self-transcendence. It's important to recognize that the whole study is based on changes in one self-report measure, which is, of course, a measure that includes some strange items, says Richard Davidson, who's a researcher on compassion meditation, who I just saw a wonderful lecture by at Trinity College. But anyway, Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, he said, this is a very strange measure. In the future, it will be important to understand why lesions in the parietal cortex induce changes on this scale. Self-transcendence, says Davidson, is an abstract concept, and different people will attribute different meanings to the words. Patient self-reporting is not always accurate, he says, adding that tapping into spirituality with more rigorous behavioral measures and pinpointing the specific thoughts and feelings that constitute it are obvious next steps. So, of course, we need much more research. Now, when Richard Davidson spoke at Trinity College as a part of our new mindfulness project at the college, he used a quote in his talk from William James, a book that he wrote in 1890 called The Principles of Psychology. He was one of the founders of modern psychology at Harvard University and very interested in religious phenomenon. And in this book, Principles of Psychology, he has several chapters about attention. One of the things he says there is, the faculty of voluntarily bringing back a wandering attention over and over again is the very root of judgment, character, and will. No one is compass sui, that is, mentally competent, if he have it not. An education which should improve this faculty would be the education par excellence. So that was William James talking about the importance of attention to education, and the chapter goes on in William James to describe more about how attention relates to learning. If you're interested in that topic, I recommend that you get a hold of David Glenn, an old buddy of mine. He just wrote an article for the Chronicle of Higher Education, where he works, called Divided Attention in the Age of Classroom Multitasking: Scholars Probe the Nature of Learning and Memory. And this is just the beginning of that wonderful essay that David has pulled together, some of the research and concerns that people have about the relationship between these two. And in particular, about the worrisome nature of multitasking, which, as you'll see, if you're a multitasker the way that I am, the news is not good on the multitasking front. Imagine that driving across town, you've fallen into a reverie, meditating on lost loves or calculating your next tax payments. You're so distracted that you rear end the car in front of you at 10 miles an hour. You probably think, damn, my fault. My mind wasn't there. By contrast, imagine that you drive across town in a state of mild exhilaration, multitasking on your way to a sales meeting. You're drinking coffee and talking to your boss on a cell phone, practicing your pitch. You cause an identical accident. You've heard all the warnings about cell phones and driving, but on a gut level, this wreck might bewilder you in a way that the first scenario didn't. Wasn't I operating at peak alertness just then? Your brain had been aroused to perform several tasks, and you had an illusory sense that you must be performing them all well. The illusion of competence is one of the things that worry scholars who study attention, cognition, and the classroom. Students' minds have been wandering since the dawn of education, but until recently, so the worry goes, students at least knew when they had checked out. A student today who moves his attention rapid-fire from text messaging to the lecture to Facebook to note-taking and back again may walk away from the class feeling buzzed and alert, with a sense that he has absorbed much more of the lesson than he actually has. Heavy multitaskers are often extremely confident in their abilities, says Clifford Nass, a professor of psychology at Stanford University, but there's evidence that those people are actually worse at multitasking than most people. Painful. Indeed, last summer, Nass and two colleagues published a study that found that self-described multitaskers performed much worse on cognitive and memory tasks that involved distraction than did people who said that they preferred to focus on single tasks. Nass says that he was surprised at the result. He had expected the multitaskers to perform better on at least some elements of the test, but no, the study was yet another piece of evidence for the unwisdom of multitasking. And I'm someone who works all day with the BBC and music in the background and 15 different screens open. So this is kind of distressing. And I believe in the importance of attention. So, but I always thought that I was training myself to be multiply attentive, to have panoramic attention of some kind, but apparently not something that people actually do. So again, that's from David Glenn's essay, Divided Attention, in the January 31 issue of the Chronicle of Higher Education at chronicle.com. This week, the American Psychiatric Association is releasing its revisions of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual DSM-5 is being published, or 6, I'm not quite sure. And one of the things that's being revised is the diagnostic criteria for attention deficit disorder. I'm not quite sure. I'll talk about this in the future, of course, because it's an ongoing interest of mine, having been my parents having been early adopters of that diagnosis. I was diagnosed when I was in first grade and given Ritalin. My kids have had the diagnosis and have also taken stimulant medication for it. So I pay close attention to this, this issue of ADHD, and a strong supporter of the efficacy of stimulant meds. There's a recent study out. This is a report that I found on brainblogger.com titled Stimulant Meds for ADHD Kids Reduce Psychiatric Disorder Risk as Adults. And this is a little bit of the summary there at brainblogger.com. The authors of a recent study published in the Journal of Pediatrics evaluated 140 white male children with ADHD over a 10-year period. They assessed the relationship between treatment with stimulants in childhood and adolescence and the later development of psychiatric disorders, as well as grade-level retention. The subjects with ADHD were compared to a group of 120 age- and gender-matched children without ADHD. At the beginning of the study, the children were between the ages of 6 and 18 years old. At the 10-year follow-up, the mean age was 22 years old. Nearly 3/4 of the children with ADHD had been treated with stimulants sometime during the 10-year period. The authors reported that these children were significantly less likely to develop anxiety and depressive disorders or exhibit disruptive behavior in young adulthood compared to ADHD children not treated with stimulants. These children were also less likely to repeat a grade level compared with untreated children. Overall, the authors conclude that stimulant treatment decreases the risk for the development of psychiatric disorders and academic failure in children with ADHD. Untreated ADHD is associated with the development of significant and potentially dangerous disorders, depression, anxiety, conduct disorders, oppositional defiant disorders, and bipolar disorders, which are also being reclassified for kids at any rate, in the DSM-5. In the pediatric study, the only disorder for which the risk was not lowered with the use of stimulant medication was bipolar disorder, and this is likely due to the fact that bipolar disorder has very different causes than the other ADHD-related conditions. So again, this was a study published in the American Journal of in the journal Pediatrics, reported at brainblogger.com in the December 2009 pages of brainblogger.com. Now, while the news for stimulant medication for ADHD has generally been positive, the evidence accumulating around the inefficacy of SSRIs, that is, antidepressant medications, has become quite distressing. And I'm going to be bringing on my friend here in Connecticut, Gary Greenberg, who just published the book Manufacturing Depression, A Secret History of a Modern Disease. He's a critic, been a longtime critic of the over-diagnosis of depression in society and of the over-medication of this particular disease. Now, I found a nice summary at Mind Hacks, which is a nice little psychology blog, nice little summary of some of the links to recent research on the inefficacy of antidepressants. So if you look for the blog Mind Hacks, he says at that blog, Newsweek has an excellent article that charts the rise and fall of antidepressants from their status as a wonder drug that made people better than well to the recent evidence that suggests that for many people, they're not much better than placebo. The piece particularly follows the work of psychologist Irving Kirsch, who was the first to conduct a meta-analysis of the effects of antidepressants back in 1998. Titled Listening to Prozac but Hearing Placebo, it suggested that the drugs were hardly more effective than placebo, and for many, marked Kirsch out as a biased and dangerous anti-psychiatrist. However, later studies in a similar vein by both Kirsch and others have supported his original findings, and many countries have now changed their treatment recommendations as a result. The Newsweek article tracks this story but also picks up on many important subplots in the story, notably that the research doesn't suggest that antidepressants are useless, quite the opposite, just that their effect is only in part due to their direct chemical effect, and that many patients in trials work out that they're not taking placebo because of the side effects, and this realization can trigger a stronger placebo effect. It also integrates evidence from the recent STARD study, one of the most complete on the best methods to treat depression. So at any rate, I recommend that you look at the Newsweek piece, the blog Mind Hacks, and look up Gary Greenberg's book, Manufacturing Depression, Secret History of a Modern Disease. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.